Intel's lost in Foundry, big Linux backdoors, container testing, Keysight snipes Spirent, Microsoft's AI Chapai, Redis reconsiders their licensing model, and governments are teaming up to make AI safe on this week's episode of the Gestalt IT Rundown. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the April 3rd episode of the Gestalt IT Rundown. And I just want everyone out there to know that if you are running a weekly news podcast, April 1st is the worst day ever, but not today. Today is actually National Chocolate Mousse Day, which I will admit are much better than the strawberry mousses out there. Or is it meese? I never remember the plural, but someone who remembers the plural for every word is, of course, my co-host, Mr. Stephen Foskett. Stephen, welcome to the show.
I've never before been accused of remembering the plural for every word, Toms. And I would also like to point out that it is, in fact, National Film Score Day. So I hope that everyone has a truly cinematic experience walking down the street while music plays.
Yes. And what else is cinematic than a great lineup of news stories that we have for you today? And we're going to be starting off with a story about Intel, because in a recent filing by Intel, it was revealed that there's an interesting twist in the new Intel Foundry operating model. The new approach separates Intel's product and foundry divisions organizationally and financially, and might lead to a spinoff IPO for one of the fabs. It certainly allows for more flexibility in sourcing and manufacturing, positioning Intel to reclaim leadership in process technology against some of the biggest competitors in the world, like TSMC. What do you make of this twist in this continuing fab strategy and story, Stephen?
Well, I'm no financial analyst. Let's focus on that first. And again, this is just the latest in the continuing Intel fab saga that we have covered here at the Rundown. But I wanted to talk about this from a bit more of a technical perspective. Now, first off, yes, there are a lot of rumors out there that this could be a prelude to Intel spinning off or doing an IPO or some kind of other thing with the fab business. But there's no suggestion of that from Intel. So that is purely speculation on the part of people like us that like to speculate on things. So let's get that straight first. The other thing is that really this is a way for Intel to show the different financial models of the fab and product division, which is probably a good idea for Intel. This is a company that has faced some, let's say, Wall Street headwinds when it comes to reporting numbers. The fab business is incredibly expensive, and Intel is going to have to invest a lot of money in it. And this way, they can at least show that that money isn't going down the drain on the product side. It's going down the drain on the fab side, at least temporarily, until that money starts bubbling back up in a gusher of, well, I'm going to stop that metaphor now. Point is, this allows Intel to more properly inform Wall Street about how the product division, product side of the company versus the fab side is doing. And that's all good news. So let's talk a little bit about why Intel thinks this might make sense. So one of the things that Intel showed in all of this financial talk was a little bit more nuts and bolts about how and when these new process nodes are coming. And that actually is pretty informative, because it shows, for example, that Intel expects that it is going to be on par in terms of competitiveness with TSMC through, maybe the next generation, but that it'll pull ahead technologically after that. How Intel is going to do this? Well, according, again, to reading the tea leaves and the graphics in these slides, Intel believes that their 18A and 14A process nodes are going to be more efficient than anything that TSMC can deliver. And most importantly, Intel feels that its packaging advantage will allow it to firmly get ahead of TSMC. If we live in a chipset world and Intel is a chiplet world and Intel is a chiplet leader, then Intel will be able to deliver products that no other company could be able to touch if they are able to execute on their vision here with the foundry operating model. On the other hand, if Intel is unable to deliver on their vision, this actually could set the company up for some kind of a fabless type split like AMD did many years ago. And that would enable Intel to have a future beyond their fab ambitions. So either way, I think that in this financial move puts Intel in a good position. And it also gives us a little bit more clarity on what they think they're going to be able to do in terms of technology. A major vulnerability was discovered in a utility library that was uncovered last week that has been over 2 years in the making. It relates to the XZUtils library, which is used for data compression for basically everything in the Linux world. A developer is now believed to be somebody working on behalf of a nation-state actor started getting involved with the project almost 2 years ago. This week, a Microsoft developer noticed irregularities in the way that SSH was processing logins due to a system he was testing. After debugging and disassembling the code, he found a backdoor that was put there by the XZUtils, which has nothing to do with SSH, and could have allowed anyone with a special payload to execute code on the target system. Patches are now being issued to remove the backdoor, and happily, this wasn't widely propagated outside of beta and alpha versions of the operating systems. Tom, this sounds crazy, but is this a sign of things to come?
I honestly think that it is, because when you look at the amount of effort that was put into this particular backdoor, this was not someone who's looking to make a quick buck. That's why a lot of people are starting to think that it was probably a nation state that did it. The person that was responsible for this, and we don't actually know that it was one person. They're now beginning to think maybe this was a whole team. They basically bullied their way into this library because it only had one developer, and he was quite possibly overworked based on what we've seen. So they offered to help. And that's what we expect in the open source community, right? Well, except what happened was that this person then went out and asked people to disable certain checks in testing code and changed all the contact information on a lot of these forum sites so that people would reach out to him directly if there were problems. And then the long game happened. And that paid off this week. So basically what was happening was they were taking code from the GitHub repository for XZUtils. They were calling other functions that then inserted code into this process. Then it would interact with daemons that were running in systemd on Linux machines. So they weren't even directly injecting the code into SSH. They were looking for very specific interaction pieces. Then you had to send it a very specially crafted certificate for login. And if there was code listed in that certificate, that's what would allow arbitrary code execution. It just so happened that a Microsoft developer happened to be testing something, noticed that SSH was taking about twice as long to log in as normal, which is still only a second or two. And it was causing specific failures in a library he was testing. Kids, that's not something that people just do to test out a new vulnerability. That is somebody who wants deep access into systems and the ability to execute code on them without anybody knowing it. And the fact that they were able to pull all this in through linking to outside libraries in the compile process. It's like if you go out to GitHub right now and you look through the code for XZUtils, you won't find a backdoor. This only got pulled in during compile time. And it only got pulled in for compile time if you were compiling an RPM or a Debian package. So they didn't even want people to do this from the compiler itself. They only wanted this to be deployed to Red Hat and Ubuntu/Debian systems. This was creative. Now, there are a lot of people out there in social media who have been asking and saying things like, well, you know, you should have been able to stop this. No, this is the kind of attack that you specifically cannot stop before it happens. This was the long game. So I think that what we're going to see is that more dedicated hackers are going to try to do this, and we're going to have to be more judicious about how we govern open source projects, especially if you are the only developer or maintainer of a project that is heavily utilized by a lot of people in the community. Because if you don't, someone could muscle in and take over. We saw this with a lot of things a few years ago, where basically people would come in, buy these development libraries, and then use them to inject crypto miners and malware into people's systems. So I think this is going to be a new avenue for people with enough backing to make it pay off over the long term. So I'm kind of curious to see what the community's response to this is going to end up being. In an attempt to catch the eye of developers, Red Hat and Docker have unveiled a new partnership that integrates Test Containers Cloud into OpenShift, offering a solution to streamline the development process, ensuring that developers can maintain platform governance, security, and compliance while enhancing efficiency and innovation. The initiative reveals to the continuing commitment from these cloud-native vendors to improving the development landscape by providing tools that support rapid iteration, compliance, and collaboration within cloud-native architectures. Stephen, I know that having container testing and things like that are super important. What does this mean for people that are users of Red Hat and Docker?
Yeah, I think this is great. Great move on the part of Red Hat to continue to embrace the modern application landscape. Red Hat's OpenShift has really become a premier cloud platform in enterprise modern application development. And so Red Hat has been making all the right moves in terms of building out systems that appeal to developers and that developers want to use. So what is Test Containers Cloud? Well, I actually experienced Test Containers years and years ago. So the project actually started way back in 2015 at the height of the Docker mania. Essentially, the idea was that, you know, sometimes when you're building applications, you need different instances of other elements in order to build out a complete system. And that's what Test Containers was. Essentially, it was a library of throwaway instances of databases, of message brokers, web browsers, essentially anything that you needed when you're building a modern cloud environment. And you could quickly and easily call those things and build up a whole environment around whatever it was that you were actually developing in order to test and see how the thing worked, to kind of prove that everything would work, that, you know, make sure that things were all integrated. And you didn't even have to leave your IDE because you could just do this all programmatically. Test Containers actually received an A round and then was purchased by Docker back in 2023, December 23, I think. And now Docker is really trying to make the most of this acquisition. Essentially, they've built a cloud version of Test Containers so that people can do this type of testing in terms of you know, checking security, checking compliance, making sure that everything works using cloud services, which makes a lot of sense. And now that cloud is going to be able to, from my understanding, to be able to run on Red Hat OpenShift as well, which will appeal to lots of the enterprise users of modern applications. So this is a really nice move, I think, on behalf of, you know, Red Hat, of course, but also in terms of Docker, because it further solidifies Docker as the developer-friendly container company. And I think that that's really going to help pay off for Red Hat and Docker going forward. People who've watched our Tech Field Day events are pretty familiar with Spirent. We've seen them quite a few times at our events. And we talked about at the beginning of March that Spirent was going to be acquired by Viavi, another company that we know. But a last-minute bid for the company came in from Keysight, yet another Tech Field Day company. And that superseded the amount of the original deal. Spirent withdrew from the former deal and accepted the latter with this 15% reported premium. The deal closed quickly thereafter, which means that Keysight is now the owner of Spirent. Tom, you're pretty familiar with all these companies. What do you make of this?
Well, I think this is just a good example of what happens whenever a company has really good technology that people want to get a hold of. And remember that that 15% premium means that this went for over £1 billion since this is valued in the UK. I think that the total amount was something like $1.16 billion. And I talked at length about this last month when we discussed, you know, why a company like Viavi would be interested in Spirent as far as doing testing and things like that. All of those things apply to Keysight as well, because Keysight is one of the larger testing firms out there. And there's a lot of value in what Spirent offers, that whole, you know, the holistic idea that companies will want to test everything in the suite, not just run individual tests, not just do those kinds of things piecemeal. And when you look at the way that things are being, you know, put through the rigors of the testing process now, you don't want to have to farm that out to three or four different organizations, because you want one company that is capable of providing certification on as much as possible, and if, especially if it's a trusted name like Keysight. I think that what just happened here was maybe Keysight looked at what was happening with Spirent and said, that's kind of a bargain. I think we need to get in on some of that action. And this happens more than you might think. You know, we've seen it happen with things like airline acquisitions, you know, where people were wanting to buy, I believe it was it Frontier or Spirit? I don't remember which one. And another company came in and was like, oh, no, we'll pay more for that. And the reason why that matters is because the company has a fiduciary responsibility to their stakeholders and their shareholders to accept the best bid for the company. So this isn't a situation of like, well, you know, they got here first, so, you know, we think that we should definitely kind of go with them. No, if the company won't match the offer, you take the highest bid out there. So I'm now kind of curious to see how Keysight integrates these pieces together. And I'm waiting to see, you know, what this rollout's going to look like. I mean, like we said, the deal kind of closed really quickly once the higher offer came in. So that means we're probably going to see this integration happen over the next quarter or so. And then those tool chains getting integrated together over the next year or so. When that happens, I'm going to be very curious to see how Keysight is going to roll this out as a holistic package to people to get them to want to buy into this big testing suite. In an ambitious move to expand computational support for AI, Microsoft's rumored Stargate project is set to become an entire cloud region dedicated to supporting large language model training in partnership with OpenAI. As reported by Timothy Prickett Morgan, this initiative is not merely about constructing another AI supercomputer, but involves building a sprawling network of data centers, potentially housing up to 1 million XPU computational devices. This bold step reflects the industry's attempt to overcome power and capacity roadblocks to deliver ever-growing demand for computational resources to support AI. Will Stargate allow Microsoft to transcend the limitations of space and time, or will the Goa'uld sweep in and try to take over, Stephen?
Well, I don't want to speculate on that last bit there, Tom. I think that's maybe beyond my pay grade. But I will say that it's interesting that this is the rumored, again, let's just take it all clear. This is all based on rumored and talk and chatter and so on. But I will say that it's interesting that they chose this name. We've been talking about this on our Utilizing AI podcast for quite a while. And of course, in Futurum Intelligence, they've been doing a lot of surveys of the AI market. And one of the challenges for next generation AI model development is that we've gotten to the point now, the AI processors themselves are incredibly powerful, but they draw a lot of power. So we've talked, of course, that, you've got limitations in terms of how much power you can have in a single rack. So the new NVIDIA announcements, for example, that we talked about in the last couple of weeks here on the rundown, you can have a 120 kilowatt rack, which is just unbelievable. Beyond the capability of a lot of data centers. But what we haven't talked about and what has been talked about quite a lot in the industry is the fact that we're getting to the point where all of those racks of AI processors are too much for any one location to handle. In other words, they're going to be consuming so much power that it's not practical to power a data center that's big enough to run the next generation AI models in one location. In fact, we're hearing rumors that already much of the development of OpenAI's next generation models and the models of other similar companies are actually spanning multiple states, multiple locations in order to have access to enough electricity in those locations. And they're using basically high performance networking, low latency, high bandwidth networking between these locations in order to try to put them together kind of like a Stargate would in this fictional universe. So that's kind of what we're thinking this is all about. The idea that Microsoft would be building a region that may actually be multiple physical locations in order to access enough power to power something that could potentially draw as much, again, as rumors are to be believed, as 5 gigawatts of power just for one giant AI monster. I will remind you that is approximately 4 time traveling DeLoreans worth of power, except continually instead of just for the moment that the lightning strikes. And that is quite a lot. Now, the article that we're linking to here, which is fantastic by our friend Timothy Prickett Morgan, talks a little bit about what that might entail. What is Microsoft going to be building that could take all this power and build all this out? The suspicion is that this would be based on Ultra Ethernet, which we've talked about. And if you check out Utilizing Tech, you'll see a great discussion with the head of the Ultra Ethernet Consortium recently. It would probably also leverage the Maya and Cobalt processors that Microsoft just introduced, rather than processors from NVIDIA, certainly, or companies like Intel and AMD. Because, again, why wouldn't Microsoft use the latest and greatest processors that they themselves have developed? And it would probably be used by OpenAI and partially funded by OpenAI, because, of course, Microsoft and OpenAI are partners, very close partners, almost purchased the company last year. So we can suspect that that's what this thing is going to be. Essentially, it's going to be a massive AI supercomputer that would draw literally, I mean, how much is 5 gigawatts? 5 gigawatts is, no kidding, 1/20th of all the solar power generated in the United States. It's like a small state worth of power, except just powering one AI compute cluster that may actually be in multiple locations. It's really incredible what they're talking about here. So we're going to be watching this closely. I think that you'll hear a lot more about Stargate on future episodes of The Rundown. The database program Redis is the latest open source project to change their licensing terms due to cloud providers. In a letter to the community, the CEO announced that they were going to be moving away from the BSD license to a source available model, SAL, and a server-side public license. The move would allow developers and teams to download and modify the source code and integrate it into their products, but cloud providers will no longer be allowed to download and use the source code for free. The Redis team says that cloud providers have been making significant amounts of money from their hard work without contributing back to the project. Tom, we've talked about licensing changes before. What do you think about this?
Well, it's interesting because I feel like history is rhyming once again. Redis came out and basically said the same thing that we've heard from companies like HashiCorp, where people are using derivatives of our software without our permission, and they're making a boatload of money from it, and we don't like that. Now, I will say something here that I think was a different tone than was taken at HashiCorp, and that is Redis is focusing specifically on the development of things. They said that while there are a couple of developers like at Microsoft and Amazon and other places that do contribute lots of code, by and large, for the amount of usage that these cloud providers get from the software, they're not contributing nearly as much code as, you know, like, you know, regular developers, you know, the mom and pop shops, if you will. So they're at least not crying about the fact that you're not paying us enough. Now, again, I want to reiterate, this is one of the problems that you have with open source software. You agree to offer it for free with licensing terms, and people can use it for whatever they want. You're going to have to take the chance that someone's going to use it to make a fortune. Basically, what they're doing now is they're saying, if you've been using it, like, you know, in a small project or using it for something else, and you're, you know, not charging or you're not charging a lot, that's great. We're going to allow you to do this. But if you are Amazon, you must agree to our new terms before you're allowed to download the source code. And I'm sure those new terms are going to involve either developer commitments or a very hefty check. And I think that we're kind of sliding towards that, where companies who are really leveraging these software pieces to make millions, if not billions of dollars, are going to have to understand that there needs to be a little bit more give and take in the community. You can't just borrow somebody's technology and not give back to it. I mean, we've been doing that with Linux for how many years? I would argue that Linux has a much more vibrant developer community than a lot of these other things, but Redis is not exactly, you know, some small single person maintained project either. But I think that what's happening is that with every one of these things that comes out, we're seeing a knee-jerk fork of the project. As soon as the announcement is made, the project is forked into, I don't know, what are we going to call this one? Open Shredder, whatever we're going to call it. not Ferritorm, because evidently that one was just a little too advanced for people. You're seeing these forks, and then you're seeing people kind of negotiating about what the value of this really is, because there are always going to be people who are like, you can't put restrictions on open source. It has to be freely available at all times, no matter what. And then you're going to see people who are like, yeah, but you can't basically build an empire off of things that other people have created for you if they're not your employees. So, but every time it happens, the tone changes, if you will. And I think that that's a valuable lesson for people to learn, is we're going to find the magic combination that's going to help the community understand we want you to develop, but we don't want you to steal. I don't think we're there yet. I think Redis is getting closer. Maybe two more revisions down the road, we'll kind of get there. But for now, if you're using Redis for your stuff, you're probably not going to be affected, other than the terms of the licenses are going to change. If you're Amazon, might be time to get some people involved who are a little bit smarter about this than your average developer. We had a story we wanted to take a closer look at this week, and surprise, it's about AI, but not what you're thinking, because the US and the UK have allied to make sure that AI is being developed safely. A new memorandum of understanding has laid out proposals for testing and information sharing to ensure that AI is being safely written and maintained to prevent harm from anyone that is using it. The ultimate goal, as stated by representatives from both governments, is the harnessing of potential of AI while ensuring that risks are understood and mitigated. And I think that this is something that a lot of people have been very curious about ever since the flap happened with OpenAI and Sam Altman being kicked off the board and kicked out of the company only to be brought back. There were these weird rumors that maybe they had made a breakthrough, or maybe they'd seen something really scary and they wanted to get rid of him. Now, ultimately, it ended up being good old fashioned greed that caused all of these problems. But it kind of got people thinking about what happens when the toothpaste comes out of that tube and AI becomes too evil for its own good. I don't want to sound like a sci-fi villain here, Stephen, but how can we prevent artificial intelligence from becoming a runaway threat to humanity?
Well, you also sound a little bit like Jon Stewart on Monday night by saying that too. He did a whole episode on that. And certainly, I think that episode of the Daily Show, which a lot of people here in the U.S. especially watch, a lot of young people, really exemplified the kind of concerns that people have about AI. It's coming for our jobs. It's, you know, we're going to be making toast for AI instead of the other way around. And I think that this memorandum of understanding kind of shows that that's being taken seriously at the highest levels of government. But another thing I will point out that that episode showed was the fact that most people in government have very little understanding of AI. In fact, everybody they interviewed said, basically, I don't know what the heck this stuff is. I don't know what it means. I don't know what it does. I hope that the United States government, the UK government, Europe, and the rest of the world will be able to embrace the understanding of experts in this field and of people like the AI safety organizations that have come out all around the world saying, you know, we need to make sure that we're careful about what's going on. So the US and the UK have, as Churchill said, a special relationship. And this is no surprise that the US and the UK would be working together on this, especially when it comes to generative AI and large language models, since we, for the most part, share a common language. And any system that would be developed in and for the United States is likely to be deployed in and for the United Kingdom as well. I guess they'll just have to add some more U's to their colors. Now, it's no surprise that this is where this would start, but I hope this isn't where this ends. I hope that the US and the UK first look toward Europe in order to embrace what they're doing as well in terms of AI safety, though maybe with a little bit more caution in terms of how it's going to affect everybody, and try to figure out how to build a common approach here. Specifically from a nuts and bolts perspective, this joint collaboration would result in the US and the UK sharing things like test plans and testing models and regulations around what these systems can do and how these systems have to be proven. And I think that that's good news overall. But at the same time, I do worry a lot about how this is going to be implemented in the real world and whether this is going to really have any effect. Tom, do you think that this is coming kind of too little too late here? Because after all, these systems are being deployed everywhere all the time.
They are, but I feel like people need to get a handle on these things. Like, don't just assume that because we didn't get in on this when it was in the Genesis phase that we can't stop it now. I will point out, of course, that part of the reason why we're partnering with the UK is because the EU has actually already come up with some of these guidelines. And oh, yeah, the UK is not part of the EU anymore. So, surprise. But I think that the important thing for people to understand is we have to have some kind of a body that is detached enough from the technology to be able to accurately assess the pitfalls of what could happen. I watched the Jon Stewart interview, and of course, or the story, and he did a great job. I'm glad he's back on TV. And yes, if you interview your average representative or senator in the US, the answer to just about everything is going to be, well, I don't know a whole lot about that. I'm just a small town country bird lawyer kind of thing, because they don't want to look smarter than their average constituent. And yes, some of those people were old enough to probably be around before computers were actually developed. But I think what's important is that slowness, that need to explain how things work to non-technical people, forces the AI people to understand that not everybody is a Silicon Valley tech bro. Like, yes, the people who work for OpenAI and all the other companies that are doing this development are deeply entrenched in it, and they understand all of the things that need to be adjusted and dealt with. Now go explain that to your grandmother. And that's where the problem falls. What is AI? Well, grandma, AI is like, now you're running into the problem. If you can't explain it to people who aren't technical, you don't understand it. And if they ask you stupid questions like, well, isn't it going to take my job? Or what happens if my toaster tries to kill me because it doesn't like the way I made toast? That's not a dumb question. That is a fear that somebody has, whether they've watched too many sci-fi movies or whether they realize that there's a very good possibility that having a script or a system that never goes to sleep and never needs to be fed or paid can do this for me. They need that system, they need that addressed. And I think that safety is more than just making sure that, you know, the AI assisted garbage disposal doesn't turn it on whenever you've got your hand down in it. I think it's understanding that human beings are going to fear things that are trying to take their jobs. We've seen that for how many years? I can remember watching news reports in the 1980s when I was a kid about how robots in car manufacturing places were going to take the United Auto Workers' jobs. Now, that hasn't happened. They've augmented their jobs. Maybe there aren't nearly as many jobs as there used to be, but it didn't eliminate the auto workers' jobs. We have to understand that, and we have to test things. We have to make sure that things aren't going to go sideways, because like we said, when other technologies do things you're not supposed to do, there's enough human interaction to prevent that from happening. Just look at VCRs. Remember how VCRs were going to destroy the film industry because then people can just tape movies and we don't have to worry about it? Yeah, that didn't work out. But it took months, years of generations of the technology to get to that point. AI is so fast that once that thing happens, it's done. Like, it can evolve from that point forward very quickly. If you've ever watched videos of neural net learning, like when it teaches itself to play a video game, it can make generational leaps in a matter of seconds because it uses those building blocks to build better. And that's why we need to have, for lack of a better term, a bunch of dullards sitting in the room saying, explain this to me, write this down in a way that makes sense, so that we know you understand what you're doing and you're adjusting for the possibility that something could go wrong and how you're going to fix it.
My biggest concern, honestly, is that people are going to have unrealistic expectations and knee-jerk reactions to a lot of this technology. I feel like after spending, you know, season after season on utilizing tech, talking to AI experts, you know, after learning about this technology, I feel like I have a moderate sense of how it works and what it is. And to me, the biggest challenge from AI is not the Terminator scenario, the, you know, your killer toasters or your, you know, killer robots even. It's humans putting this technology to work in places that it doesn't belong. you know, we've seen some really interesting recent news stories where an airline's AI-based chat assistant invented a new rule, and a court forced the airline to uphold that rule because, after all, this is your tool that did that. Another moment in that same episode of The Daily Show was talking to the FTC commissioner, and she mentioned that just because something is done in a new technological way doesn't change the responsibility of ownership of that action. I think that's really important when we talk about AI restrictions and AI regulations. If you're going to be deploying AI to do a function on behalf of yourself or your business, you are responsible for what happens, whether that's an autonomous vehicle or a chatbot or wholesale text and image and video generation. If you deploy a tool that makes something easier, that doesn't mean you can wash your hands from the results. And if your car runs into a person because you were using self-driving technology, well, you and the creator of that technology bear the responsibility for what happened there. It's the same thing with anything. And I think that that is a fundamental understanding that maybe could be understood even by the types of people who are in government and trying to build laws around this. Essentially, you're responsible for your actions, even if those actions were taken on your behalf by a tool that you didn't properly understand. And the reason that I'm harping on that is because it's become incredibly clear that many people, even people in the technology industry, don't understand what large language models are and what they're doing and what they can and can't do. And I'm seeing a lot of irrational exuberance for these things where people are saying, well, now, since this is a credible output, I'm just going to turn that on and make it automatic, and I'm never even going to look at what the output of this thing does because it just works. Well, it doesn't just work. And I hope that the folks listening to this and the folks in our industry who are trying to deploy AI will embrace that philosophy that this is just a tool. It's just a tool that does some pretty spectacular things, but that doesn't mean that we can just let it go and do its own thing. We're still responsible for it. And if we aren't, if we don't have that understanding, well, I think that this news suggests that at least the US and the UK government and the government in Europe and other places are going to hold us responsible for what's happening.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Stephen, but I wanted to let everybody out there know that we here are responsible for some pretty spectacular things too. And they're coming up next week. I'm going to be out in Silicon Valley for Security Field Day 11, where we're going to be talking about all things related to security. You know, some of the things we talked about in this episode and some things that we're not with companies like Ariaka, Palo Alto Networks, Zerto, and Index Engines. So make sure you're tuning in next week, April 10th and 11th. That means that Steven's going to have a co-host for that episode of the Rundown. But don't worry, I'm still going to be having fun without him. And then next month in May, we're going to be having Mobility Field Day. This is one of our big flagship events that is one of the things that the industry is super excited about. And I'm super excited to announce that we have a brand new company that's going to be presenting there, Cisco. Yeah, that's right. You know, they were a highlight last fall at Mobility Field Day 10. We're bringing them back for Mobility Field Day 11. I hear they've got some cool stuff coming out. I can't wait to see more about it. And then after that, Stephen, you've got something super exciting that people need to know about.
Absolutely. We're doing our first ever App Dev Field Day. So if you followed along with Cloud Field Day, you've seen the impact of modern applications and modern platforms on the enterprise IT environment as a whole. Well, we're going to be going to the next level here with App Dev Field Day. We're going to be talking to companies that are basically platforms and above, companies that are developing new containerization, orchestration, observability, all of that. And of course, application development, real application development matters as well. So keep an eye out as we announce some of the companies that are coming to App Dev Field Day. We've got some contracts coming in and we're going to be start announcing those as well. Also, we've got the annual 6.5 Summit from the Futurum Group coming up. Check that out, June 11th to 13th. They're starting to make announcements of keynotes and of companies that are presenting there. And that same week, we're going to be doing Cloud Field Day as well. And we'll be coordinating Cloud Field Day and the 6.5 Summit. So you'll be seeing sort of live reactions and live reporting as the 6.5 Summit is going on from the Cloud Field Day community. So we're pretty excited to see how that all works out. And we'll be doing a lot more of this going forward in the future.
Exactly. And that's one of the exciting things about all the things that we do here at Tech Field Day is we're always investigating new areas. We're always talking to companies that are on the cutting edge of technology, whether it's AI or not, we're there. And in the meantime, when we're not at Field Day, we're filling you in on all the great news that happens during the week here on The Rundown every Wednesday. Make sure you are subscribed to our YouTube channel and you're subscribed to the Gestalt IT Rundown in your favorite podcatcher. That way you won't miss any of the great stories, some of the cool facts, how you know what Wednesday it is today if we don't tell you that it's Chocolate Mousse Day or National Tweed Day. Okay, let's be fair, Tweed. Okay. But we will be back next week with another great episode. Stephen will have a co-host since I'll be at Security Field Day. But don't worry, we'll be bringing you great news, great exciting things going on. And we can't wait to see you soon. And remember, Jaffa Creed. Thank you.